Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Happy birthday to everybody. Yeah, happy 245th birthday on the our feast day. So how exciting is that? Yeah. Always one of the best days of the year. You know, I was thinking about my birthday experiences. And I've celebrated the Marine Corps birthday all over the world. Yeah. I've been aboard ship. I've been in the middle of nowhere in the United States. I've been on the other side of the world in Iraq and Afghanistan. Celebrated in each nation. And I was thinking, like, what's my most memorable Marine Corps birthday experience? And the one that leaps to my mind you know, the one that jumps to mind is a funny one, actually. It's going to a Marine Corps birthday for 1st Battalion, 4th Marines. One of my good friends, Battle Buddy times two, Chris Bronzy, who's now the CO of the 15th MU. He was the commanding officer of 1-4. So we get invited to the birthday. I do, and I say, "Can I bring my daughter?" She says, "Absolutely, man." So we would be honored for them to attend, right? So so Catherine and Colleen, and it's at the Disneyland Hotel here in Anaheim. They won't call it hotel anymore. It's a resort complex now, as it goes. So we're going to spend the night at the Disneyland Hotel, and we're going to go to 1-4's ball. And for those of you who have never been to one of our birthday balls, I always joke about it is the prom gone wrong, okay? But if you look at just the optics of it, it's a beautiful event, right? And it's full of our pageantry and our history, which makes it better. So you have, you know, Marines in their uniform, in their dress blue uniforms, and come on, there's no better looking uniform in the United States military. And you see everybody's dates, and they look great, whether they're guys in tuxedos and suits or whether they're girls in their prom dresses. But there is kind of a little bit of a flourish with the prom dresses. These are the prom dresses that you wanted to buy in high school, but your mom wouldn't let you. So now that you're not in high school anymore, you buy the prom dress you want to buy. Yeah. So, and these are women that are attracted to Marines, or at least are going to a dance with them. So they're their own gifted group as well. So you have this prom, this spectacular party that's going to occur. So my daughters and I go, right? And it's a beautiful event, right? And so with an infantry battalion, you have approximately 1,000 Marines. 60% of them, 60 to 70% are under the age of 26. Okay? So it's a youthful group. And, you know, one of the cool things about not having it at a casino is that, you know, the Marines hang out and they'll dance and they'll drink and they'll have a good time. If you have it at a casino, as soon as the, you know, almost as soon as the dinner is done, the speaking is done, and you adjourn the event, you know, they spill out back into the casino. I'm not as much of a fan of that, although that tends to be on the West Coast. That tends to be where they head. But anyway, so we are at the Disneyland Hotel, and we go to this event before the ball, and that Lieutenant Colonel Bronzy at the time was hosting. And, I mean, it's a great time. There's friends of mine that are there. My two daughters are here with me tonight. And so then we go downstairs. Now, Colleen, this is how many years ago? Colleen's 17 now. She's probably 11 or 12 when this happened. Okay, so we're back from Afghanistan. It's a few years later. And now we're down in the main ballroom, and, you know, they're assembling, and they play the bugle call, and people start coming in, and, you know, I don't know, it's a 15-minute warning, and then a 5-minute warning, everybody's in place. And so the ball starts, right? I mean, so it's like everybody sits down, and, you know, the chaplain does his thing, and Colleen says, "Could I go to the bathroom?" And I said, "Yeah." So off she goes to the bathroom. She comes back. She says, "You won't believe what happened in there." And I said, "What?" She said, "Well, there was a girl puking in the garbage can." And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yes, she's getting sick." I said, well, "What was going on?" She said, "Well, her friends were trying to help her. And then I was waiting to go to the bathroom, and then these boy Marines walk in the girl's bathroom." I said, "Well, they probably got lost." And she said, "Dad, they were arguing that we were in the wrong bathroom and that we had to get out." I said, "Well, then what happened?" And she said, "Well, girls started throwing stuff at him and telling him to get out. And so they left." I said, "Wow." And so so the event goes on. So I don't know, 15 minutes later, Colleen says, "Could I go to the bathroom again?" And she said, I said, yeah, you know, whatever, go ahead. So she goes, she comes back. She sits down and she says, you won't believe what happened this time, Dad. And I said, well, what now? And she said, well, there were Marines and they were carrying a Marine. It looked like he had passed out. I said, well, maybe he slipped and hit his head. And she looked at me and she said, I think he was drunk. I said, oh, yeah? And she said, yeah. And then she said, and then I was in the bathroom. This girl was really mad because her boyfriend, you know, was being a jerk. And she was, like, using really bad language. And so I said, anything else? And she said, no, that was it. And so anyway, Colleen's like, and she has her prom dress on, right? I still have one of my favorite pictures of my daughters and I. And so now, right, the speeches get given, we eat dinner, right? The music plays and we're dancing. My daughters and I are dancing. So Colleen and I are dancing, and I spin Colleen. Colleen has this Marine Corps pendant that I bought her for the dance, right? So she has it on, and I go to spin her under my, you know, under my arm, and her pendant catches on my sleeve buttons of my mess dress uniform. Okay, so you're a field grade officer, you wear this tuxedo, right? And it's a cool looking tuxedo. And so anyway, Colleen's pendant catches on my buttons and it blows up. The chain goes one way, the pendant goes up in the air, and it's on the dance floor. But there's all these people dancing, so we're looking for it. We can't see it. So we both get down on our knees, our hands and knees, and we're looking for it, right? And just as we're doing this, maybe 10, 15 feet away, somebody's date in a long white dress had hiked the dress up to like hip level. And now she squatted down and she's twerking. So Colleen and I are down on our knees and we look over as this girl like drops into the squat position with her dress hiked up to like hip level and, lower hip, upper thigh level, right? And I don't mean moderately upper thigh. I mean like, you know, north, upper thigh. So, so I look at Colleen and she's got both eyes on this girl, right? And she looks at me and I said, unbelievable. And Colleen looks at me and says, this is the best. And I remember thinking, God help us, right? God help Susan and I. She's supposed to recoil at this shit. But we had an awesome night at the end of the dance and all that. You know, we walked around the hotel and then went up to the room and had, I think we had 8 pancakes at like midnight or something like that. And the pancakes come shaped as, you know, Mickey Mouse, right? There's a circular one and then there's two, like one for the ears. And then there's something on the pancakes that look like Mickey's mouth and his nose and all that. So, no, and I think of all the different places I've ever spent the Marine Corps birthday, for whatever reason, that memory is chief among all. I mean, I've had the privilege of being the oldest Marine in the ceremony in Afghanistan when we were in the Helmand province. I was also the oldest Marine at the ball for, who did I go speak for? I went and spoke at a ball. Well, last year I spoke at Marine Wing Support Squadron's ball. And I'll tell you what, that was, I had a couple cool experiences there. that I'll never forget. One is I'm standing in line to check into Caesar's Palace. They got me the nicest hotel room I've ever stayed in. Yeah, bar none. Bar none. Okay. And so I'm standing in line to check in. And these two Marines are standing in front of me. Obvious because they're haircuts. And I'm standing there. And I said, so we're standing there talking. I said, you guys here for a ball? And they said, yeah, we are. And I said, which one? And they said, Marine Wing Support Squadron, 372. And the Diamondbacks. And I said, I'm your guest speaker. And then one of them looks at me and says, you're Mac? And I said, I am. And he said, we've heard good things about you. I said, come on, man. You don't have to say that just because I'm the guest speaker. And he said, no, you're coming to speak to the battalion after the first of the year, right? And I said, I am. And he said, no, we've heard really cool things about you, and so we're looking forward to it. And I said, come on. And they both said, oh, no, straight up. And I was like, wow, things you don't hear very often about somebody being a guest speaker. And so that was the start of it. And then after, and so during, you know, I made my remarks, and it was kind of cool because I was going to go speak to the whole, you know, squadron later. So it was kind of I'm not going to bend your ear tonight too much, but I have a couple things I want to tell you. And then they presented me with a picture. Now, this picture is a picture of part of the squadron in their dress blues, and they take care of all the support at Marine Corps. Not all the support, but their portion is they have wreckers, they have cranes, they have forklifts, they have all the heavy machinery that does the heavy lifting at the airfield. That's what they do. Right. And they're expeditionary, so they could do that anywhere in the world. They could pack their shit up and go. So anyway, there's a picture of them in formation and with the, in their dress blues with the company guidons out there. And then there's a picture of, their leadership. And then they had the blue flag that I use as the logo for post-traumatic winning. So they have that instead of like the battalion color bearers, you know, holding the Marine Corps, their Marine Corps, battle colors. So it'd be specific to their squadron, right? So it's the Marine Corps colors. And then the streamer that goes across the bottom normally says, you know, whatever your unit is. So 5th Marine Regiment, in this case, Marine Wing Support Squadron 372. It would say that. But the guy doesn't have that flag. Instead of that flag, he's got this white flag with a blue W on it, which I use for the post-traumatic winning logo. So we're standing outside of the ballroom afterwards, and I don't know, it's a group of maybe a dozen people, and we're talking and whatnot. And, you know, guys and their wives and, you know, female Marines and their dates or husbands or whoever. And so they, I said, I look at the picture and I hadn't had time to scrutinize it. And so I look at it and I look at the sergeant major and the battalion commander and the squadron commander. And I said, did you Photoshop the white flag into the picture? And he looks at me and he says, we didn't Photoshop anything. And I said, what? He said, we didn't Photoshop anything in that picture. And I said, and I look, now I'm standing there with the picture, and the picture may be I don't know, it might be 24 inches by 24 inches. Okay. And so it's this big picture. It's their, it's a wooden version of their battalion, their squadron logo. It's a plaque that says presented to Major Michael F. McNamara. Here, I'll read, it's on my wall. I love this thing, right? At the 244th Marine Corps birthday ball, your strong moral character and positive words of wisdom will not be taken lightly. Your leadership has helped set the foundation for the future success for all Marines. Thank you for your dedication and service to the United States Marine Corps. Once a Marine, always a Marine. So there's that plaque in the center, and off to the left, right? It's you know, so it's matted and sunken in the matted in the matted piece is this blue flag again, this white flag with the blue W on it. So now I take this thing and I look and I said, well, wait a minute. That flag, and I'm looking at it, and then it dawns on me. They got everybody's ass out there. They got their equipment. They got in uniform just to take that picture for me. And I will never forget that moment at a birthday ball where somebody was so moved by what post-traumatic winning has done for their Marines, or in this case, what, you know, he had seen it. He was bringing it to his Marines, and this was kind of the opening act of it. I was just blown away. It was just an awesome night for me. And throughout the course of the night, I had Marines who had not even seen post-traumatic winning coming up to me and telling me they were excited to see it and whatnot. And so that was another great birthday, great birthday ball. I've only had the opportunity to spend one with one of my sons, and that was Patrick. He got a chance to. He and I got a chance to spend one ball together a couple years ago when he was still with 3-5. So my birthday memories, and then, you know, I mean, and then the ones you spend when you're deployed with Marines are always special. Whether it's you're out doing training and they can't bring you back, and so you find some way to get something that resembles a cake, and you read General Zhurin's message, and we celebrate it. You know, and the cool part about this week for Marines, if you're a Marine family member, my ex-wife, who's was the wife of a Marine, her two sons are Marine. One of the great quotes my ex-wife had: Patrick, our number two son, is going to OCS, and so the OSO here in Orange County, he has a dinner, and we go to it. And so, you know, we're sitting there and there, you know, and there's families there and people nervous about, you know, going to OCS. Will they be able to get through and blah, blah, blah. You know, well, Patrick's attitude was, I better be able to get through because this is, you know, I can't fail when my dad and brother have got through this, right? So we're there, and you know, they. I think the OSO said, the OSO says, any words of advice to me? And I, you know, I think I just said, don't quit. Don't quit. No matter how bad it gets, do not quit. Because that's what it's designed to test. Will you quit? And just remember, at some point, if you keep putting one foot in front of another, somebody will come up and tell you to stop. Do not quit, ever. And so, you know, and so then, you know, he looks at Mike's wife and he says, Susan? And Susan looks at these kids and says, time to man up, boys. And Patrick was sitting there, and he just started laughing. He shook his head, right? It's like, yeah, not too many moms say shit like that. But it was all, I mean, let me tell you. I mean, Susan's been around the Marine Corps, right? Our oldest son had gone through, right? She'd seen me. And, you know, but again, still to this day, makes me laugh, right? Makes me laugh. So anyhow, it's always this week though, there's this special spirit around where everywhere you go, people say happy birthday. You know, happy birthday, Marine. And we celebrate our birthday like nobody's. Other services have kind of tried to get into the act, but nobody does the self-love like Marines do. We love our birthday. And from the time you get into the Marine Corps, right, it's a big our birthday is a big deal. And you see it. And at first it's like, well, what's a big, you know, it's a Marine Corps birthday, man. Oh, shit. And I've told this story before, but the first birthday I ever spent in the Marine Corps was I was in officer candidate school. And we had probably 4 weeks left. And we had 4 weeks left, and they were having the birthday on Friday night. So so our platoon commander brought his dress blues, and when he got ready, he got dressed, right? And we saw him kind of bouncing around before he left, right? In his dress blues, with all his shit on, right? And we were like, whoa, look at Captain Rankin, man. How cool is that? And it was cool. It was cool. And so the next day, we go for a run. And that's the story I tell about. And we're running. I mean, OCS running is not like normal Marine Corps, you know, kind of going at kind of the slowest guy's speed. So We our platoon commander, Captain Rankin, who I told you about, right? He all of a sudden spins out of the run and bends over and he pukes. He pukes this brown puke. He must have been drinking bourbon, man. He pukes this brown puke, and we go running by, and he's puking everywhere. I mean, it's not like he like spit up like a baby, right? Like prime rib and all. Right. And we're running by going, holy shit, look at that. You know, I mean, these guys are invincible, right? And now he's like peeled off, like puking. Right. And again, puke everywhere, right? On his arms. And then, you know, I remember, this is another great birthday memory, but we keep running. And I don't know, a minute, 90 seconds later, here he comes running to catch us. And he's got puke on his arms, and he's wiping it off his mouth. Where the fuck do you think you're going without me? Ah. And I just remember thinking, you're still civilian, right? They're trying to mold you into a Marine, but you're in some state of evolution, right? You're not there yet. And I just remember thinking, wait a minute, man. When you puke, aren't you supposed to lay down and somebody gets you ginger ale and crackers and puts a washcloth on your head? You keep running? Like you come back and like, and it was an epiphany for me. And I just remember thinking, you know what? The rules as I know them right, are not the rules that these crazy asses play by. They don't play by. This is like bizarro land, and they make up their own macho tough guy rules. And this is the world that I wanted a piece of. Like, what? But no, I mean, in OCS, I'll never forget that. That was a Marine Corps birthday story, too. And, he rejoined us, and he finished the run, finished everything else we did, walked inside like nothing happened. You're like, did that happen? Or is that a figment of my imagination? Oh, no, it happened. And now we're just going to pretend like it didn't happen? Well, if he's pretending like it didn't happen, what are the rest of us going to do? Ask him about it? That ain't happening. So, anyhow, my birthday memories. I have some awesome ones. And most of them revolve around things, really funny, cool things that have happened to me. So, should we play the Commandant's birthday message? Probably appropriate, right? So let me tell you what we're going to do today. You're going to hear a couple interviews I've done. One is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done on All Marine Radio, and that is with a guy by the name of Cal Humphrey. He is the uncle of a good friend of mine by the name of Jess Humphrey. Cal was a PFC on Iwo Jima and legendary Marine Corps battle, right? But he is just this incredibly soft-spoken guy, and tells this incredible story about his life and being a Marine on Iwo Jima. And I love the interview, and so you'll hear that today. And then after that, you'll hear an interview that I did with Medal of Honor recipient Woody Williams. Had a chance to interview him at the Marine Corps Marathon. And so you'll hear that as well. So on a day that we celebrate, as General Neller says, remember the past. Honor those that have fallen and gone before us. And think about the future. That's what the Marine Corps birthday is about. If you're a Marine. And this year, because of COVID, there's no Marine Corps balls. So I think some units are going for runs. So I was asking the other day when I was down at 3-5, so what do you guys, no ball this year? And they're like, no, sir, no ball this year. So I said, so what are you guys doing? And they said, well, I guess we're going on a 12-mile run. And I said, a 12-mile run instead of the ball? And they said, yes, sir. You know how officers are. They think that kind of shit's cool. And I started laughing. I said, yeah, not all of us did. And I said, 12 miles is 12 miles, man. That's a long-ass run. They're like, no shit, sir. So my own opinion is, and they'll run a mile or two, and then there'll be some event. I don't know that for a fact. Maybe they will run 12 miles, but if they do, good luck, boys. Don't fall out. Don't be a cheese ball. So on this Tuesday morning, the 10th day of November, which also happens to be, the birthday of my number two son, Patrick. So happy birthday to number two on your scorecard, number one in your heart today, Patrick Francis. Yeah. So, I'll tell you what, very, very cool experience last week in that, doing post-traumatic winning with Patrick's old battalion, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. Let me read you what my son wrote. And I asked him, I said, hey, do you want to make any comments on video or audio? Or he said, well, how about if I write something? So The first company I did this with last week was Patrick's old company, Kilo Company. And one of Patrick's Marines took his life this past summer from Kilo Company. So this is what my son wrote. And so I put a picture of Corporal Shane Bronlick up on the screen, a couple of them, one him individually and another one with what looks like his squad. And this is what my son wrote, whose birthday it is today. This is Corporal Bronlick, 2nd Squad, 2nd Platoon, Kilo Company. If this class was 2 years ago, he'd be sitting in the audience with you. Corporal Bronlick had been in my platoon from the day I checked in. I found out soon after that he had a rough upbringing and had had traumatic events in his past. Besides keeping to himself, you would have never known. This past June, Corporal Bronlick took his own life. In the months that have gone by, I can't help but look back and wonder what we could have done to help him. The one thing that I wish is that we could have provided more tools to help Corporal Bronlick deal with his emotional trauma. We all knew about the trauma that he had, but we didn't know what to do about it besides listen when he spoke about it. The one thing I hope you're able to get out of this class is a tool to help with situations like this and apply it to your Marines. I'm hopeful that if you combine the lessons learned from this presentation along with caring for your Marines, the number of Marines who feel like they are alone in dealing with trauma and feel that suicide is their only option can be reduced. Patrick McNamara, 2nd Platoon, Kilo Company. So it's a talk about a wonderful experience. You know, post-traumatic winning, doing it, is always full of, I mean, just profound experiences for me. And it happened to me all weekend, right? As Marines reached out, wanted to talk, some came to dinner. But to do it with your son, a little bit different, right? And, you know, you work your whole life to help create a human being that might write something like that. And so I'll never forget last Friday, because not only did I do post-traumatic winning, but, you know, my son helped. And that made it all the more special. So on this November 10th, happy birthday to everybody, to include twice to my son Patrick, the United States Marine Corps Band makes this morning official. Good morning to you. This is dedicated to every Marine and sailor who's ever served with us on this on our feast day. So happy birthday, Marines, and happy birthday to all the sailors that have supported us. God bless you. And a second happy birthday and to my son, Patrick. So this is dedicated to all of you. We fight our country's battles.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Hey, I'm not going to lie to you, man. It's cold in California this morning. Got into the 40s last night. That's like being in the 20s or the low teens in the upper Midwest. Like, it's crazy. It's not supposed to happen here. I know. I can hear the sympathy. Partly sunny in 69. Nice day on the East Coast in Quantico. Down the coast of Camp Lejeune, it is partly sunny 79. 29 Palms, sunny and 49. Yeah. What do you think the overnight low was in 29 Palms if it's 49 right now and sunny? Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton, sun and 57. Camp Smith in Hawaii, sun's coming up and 70 degrees. Okinawa, dark cloudy, 71 down under. For Marine Rotational Force Darwin, it's warm, dark, cloudy and 84. And in Norway, in Oslo, it is cloudy late in the day, and it is 41 degrees. Currently at the home of All Marine Radio, sunny and 54 degrees. Looking for a high all the way up to 67 this afternoon. Come, what happened to like low 70s? What's going on here? I'm not exactly sure. All right, we'll take a quick break. And no, you know what? We're not going to take a quick break. The Commandant's message, you're going to hear that right now. So, Commandant now everybody produces a video, right? That's the message. So you're going to hear music, and then it's a scene of, and I'll put the link in with the, with the video, so if you're looking for it, you can find it. But it starts with kind of a panoramic shot from a drone that kind of zooms in on a guy in a corral. You don't know it, but it's in West Virginia, and this is the farm of Woody Williams, the last Medal of Honor recipient from World War II that's still alive. He was awarded his Medal of Honor for his actions as a flamethrower Marine on Iwo Jima. And life expectancy of those dudes was not very long, man. And the interview, you know, why does Woody Williams join the Marine Corps? He saw some guy wearing a Marine uniform in his town in West Virginia and said, if I wear one of those uniforms, I could get a girl. And that piece of bad judgment gets him to Iwo Jima as a flamethrower man. And the rest is history. He is a wonderful, wonderful man. Has a foundation that puts up memorials to Gold Star families around the country in different cemeteries. And so you'll hear the interview I did with him at the Marine Corps Marathon. So this is General Berger's, the Commandant of the Marine Corps. This is the message to the Marine Corps on the occasion of the 245th Marine Corps birthday, and also I'm sure you'll hear, I haven't seen this, you'll hear from Sergeant Major Black, the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. So here you have it. Happy birthday, everybody.
I am absolutely proud to be a Marine. I'm proud of my service. I'm proud of the fact that I was in a position to do something to preserve my freedom and to hold on to those values that can only be had by free people.
Trust is not given, nor is it easily earned. Today, the trust of the nation is our inheritance, a trust earned through the selfless valor and determined actions of generations of Marines on the distant shores and misty battlefields of our storied past.
We were really snowed as to why we would need so many Marines to take this little piece of rock. But after the first day, when they lost so many wounded and killed, they announced that night, you know, we're going ashore. And the island was so different in its appearance from Guam and the other islands that we'd been on. There was no jungle, wasn't anything. Even though we'd been in combat before, you could see right off it wasn't going to be anything like what we had experienced before.
Long before we wear the uniform, long before the eagle, globe, and anchor is etched on our soul, we sense the special appeal that sets Marines apart. Our ethos, values, and character speak to our nation's heart.
All I wanted was an opportunity. Don't give me anything else. Just let me, you know, just show me the way and I'll get it done.
This is Major Jim Capers. I believe he's a Navy Cross recipient from Vietnam. And there's people that are trying to get his Navy Cross upgraded to the Medal of Honor. But this is him talking right now.
And that was my motivation. I got an opportunity to serve in the Marine Corps, and I chose Special Forces. You know, I chose Force Recon, and I did three tours in Force Recon. Did fairly well. Got a chance to be a combat swimmer. Made three combat dives and two swims of 1,500 meters in enemy territory. And we fought our way from the DMZ back to Atlantic City. And Team Broadminded, it was my team.
Our nation expects us to be the world's finest military professionals, to be capable and ready, and to represent all that is good about the United States. A nation of diverse heritages, united by common values.
There's no tighter unit in the world than the Marine Corps.
This is James Stogner. He's a Navy Cross recipient, Lance Corporal from Vietnam.
I mean, you join the Air Force, you join the Navy, you become a Marine. And it's something that sticks with you the rest of your life.
The spirit of this ethos is born in the hearts of men and women by a common calling, a desire to serve, and a sense of duty born in ideals like patriotism, valor, and fidelity.
When the Japanese struck Pearl Harbor, the atmosphere of the country was entirely different.
This is Dorothy Cole. She's 107 years old. Stories written about her earlier this year. She was a sergeant in the Marine Corps during World War II.
Different than it is now. So everyone was talking and trying to figure out what they could do. I decided that I would go into the Marine Corps, no matter who you are, do some kind of service for your country. I've always been proud to say that I was in the Marine Corps.
Our ethos is who we are and what we believe.
I was 18 years old, and you find out what you got when you need it. And I just thought I wasn't going to die that. The NVA had came into our perimeter. All I had was a K-bar. I crawled over and I found my assistant gunner. We could hear Eli, the gunner, was shot up, and they'd come in and took Eli and drug him back into the Hamlet. So I told Bob, I'm going after Eli. And I just went screaming, and I dove in, and I dispatched him. And then I picked Eli up, I picked the gun up, and I got us the hell out of there.
To be courageous is to do what is right, to adhere to a higher standard of personal conduct, to lead by example, and to make tough decisions under stress and pressure. Marines train, Marines fight, and Marines win. Always.
We set up security.
Gunnery Sergeant Juan Rodriguez, Juan Rodriguez Chavez, a Navy Cross recipient from Afghanistan.
And they took off into the patrol into the village. 0530, that's when the fireworks started. We're trying to find our way over there, and the second time we found more, you know, and some of them were dead, and some of them were alive trying to take cover. I sped up and got between the village and the guys that were our guys. Yeah, we were getting shot at, and Myra was just going away, just boom, 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 boom. I'm alive because of Myra. I'll be dead honest with you. I've never seen a young man have that much courage.
Our nation finds in its Marine Corps men and women committed to preserving trust that's been built over the last 245 years. Marines, once transformed, are forever changed. Instilled with the beliefs, ideals, and virtues that have meaning deeper than words. These ideals, honor, courage, commitment, form the bedrock of our institutional and individual character. On this birthday, our nation finds in its Marine Corps men and women who know the meaning of patriotism, valor, duty, strength, discipline, and innovation. We must be faithful to our country, to our Corps, and to each other. This faithfulness must never be compromised. We must respect each other, believe in each other, trust each other.
Our nation finds in its Marine Corps a ready and capable force, never content with the status quo or being average. Marines meet and exceed the standard. That is what Marines do, and that is what the nation expects.
That voice belongs to the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, in case you don't recognize it.
Semper Fidelis, and happy birthday, Marines.
I will put the link to the video in there. You could find it just about anywhere, though. And the Marine Corps always does great stuff. I would, if I was to give any advice to whoever produced that, and I would say this is typical for a lot of video productions. Their background music overtakes the often compromises what's being said. In particular, during major capers, I mean, you struggle to hear what he's saying. And I don't. And you know what? Again, it's editors that do that stuff. And, you know, they get so into their music and stuff like that and the dramatic effect of it and what they're trying to achieve that they sometimes step on somebody's words, which I think is the guts of what you're producing. But now the Marine Corps always does great stuff. And this is, I mean, this is an awesome video. You know, different shots. One of the cool shots at the end is Amtrak's in the water headed for the beach. And, you know, if you've ever been a part of it, it's pretty cool, man. Pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff when you see the way the Marine Corps does what it does. But so celebrating all that today, you know, honor the past, remember those that have gone before us, not only who have fallen in combat, but also who just wore the title Marines and then went back to their community and lived great lives and made a great difference. I always say, you know, one of the great experiences of this show is that, you know, the things that Marines do during operations around the world are amazing. The things they do after they get out of the Marine Corps are equally as amazing. And I've had the privilege for now 4.5 years to tell those stories and take your breath away. And never gets old. What they do in communities is just, you know, really special and really cool. And again, I believe what makes Marines different is their DNA. I believe that in my heart of hearts. And Marine Corps does it, you know, rough them up, then shine them up and put them in cool looking uniforms and all that. I do, but and that's part of it. But what truly makes Marines different is the DNA that walks through the door. And I go out of my way when I do post-traumatic winning to talk about that. Right? What organization recruits with a slogan, "Maybe you could be one of us"? Find one. Find somebody that recruits with a slogan like that, and then they back it up with "the few, the proud." Well, already you're telling people that, yeah, you probably can't, right? And you're recruiting. That's how you recruit. Well, who does that resonate with when you tell them, yeah, you probably can't? What the fuck did they just say? Yeah, you probably won't be able to do it. Oh, the fuck I won't? That's a different human being right there. That is a different human being. And the difficulty factor with our recruit training keeps a whole segment of the American population out of the Marine Corps. Not sure I could do it. Well, if you're not sure you could do that, then we don't want to take us with you when we do all the other shit we do, right? If that's what scares you away. And so the person that walks through that door that says, yeah, I'll try that, not knowing if they could do that, in my opinion, that's what makes the Marine Corps different. It's that human capital that then gets built upon and becomes magical things. And I'll tell you what, if you want to see an organization at its best, find the Marine Corps when everything's going wrong and watch what happens. And, you know, again, quintessential Marine moments, right? 1st Marine Division at the Chosin Reservoir. Surrounded, the Chinese everywhere, you know, nothing going right. And what do? They get after it. You know, 1st Marine Brigade at the Pusan perimeter. 1st Marine Division at the Incheon landing. Right? 2nd Marine Division on Tarawa. And what you see throughout is that same spirit that says, you what do you mean? You don't think I'll do this? You know, bullshit. Of course I'll do it. Or who said we couldn't do that? Of course we're doing that. And I tell stories that when we ripped when we did our relief in place with the 82nd Airborne, I was doing operations. I was in the G3 at the time. And so you know, we become friends with the 82nd Airborne planners and whatnot, and their ops guys and all of that. And you're seeing what they do, how they do it, and then, you know, our plan of what we're going to do. And the chief difference for, just say, a airborne battalion or maybe a mech battalion that's in a battle space, maybe 500 to 650 dudes. Marine Corps Battalion, 1,200 reinforced, 1,200 Marines. And so the Army would tell us stuff like, yeah, well, we don't go here in Fallujah, or we don't go into Karma, or we don't go, right? Mm-hmm. So the actual transfer of authority took when we ran everything takes place at 0001. When we get to 0001 on whatever day in March of 2004, the Marine Corps owned it. And I want to say at 001 and 4 seconds, into every one of those places that we got told the Army didn't go, Marines walked into or drove into. And all hell broke loose. But it's what, you know, it's what I love about the culture of the Marine Corps. It's what I've always loved. And that is, you know, people who set their jaw, people who bow their neck, right? And they look around and they say, let's go, boys and girls. And we go, right? And it is the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life. The courage and selflessness of Marines under pressure every day, not every once in a while. Not when they get around to it, but whenever you ask them, whenever you call on them, that's what you see. And it is, I think it's the coolest organization on the planet, honestly. With all of its warts, I think the greatest organization, the greatest team I've ever been on, from Jack Riley. Marines, wishing each of you a happy birthday. Most of you, like myself, will be honored to be the oldest Marine present at today's cake ceremony. So take a moment. Remember our brothers way back when we enjoyed the piece of cake we celebrated in Vietnam. God bless you all. Semper Fidelis, Jack Riley. From William Mason, Ohio man. I've done birthdays in garrison in Japan, in the middle of nowhere in Saudi Arabia, as the OIC of a displaced radar detachment. My fondest birthday memory was in Pensacola in 1988. I had been drafted to be in the uniform pageant as a World War I Marine. Several of us were getting on an elevator to go up to stage level. And then in parentheses, he said it was a huge place. Someone said, make a hole, and retired Marine Commandant Barrow boarded the elevator. We were bunched in pretty tightly, and General Barrow took the far corner right next to me. He's at the rear, facing forward, while I am facing him from his left side. His serious rack, which he's talking about, General Barrow's medals, with a Navy cross on top, is staring me in the face. I'm saying a silent prayer that nobody bumps me into the general, as I was terrified at the thought of fouling his uniform. He looked at me and smiled and said, how you doing, Lieutenant? In that Louisiana drawl. Fine, sir, barely escaped my throat, and I'm sure I sounded like Mickey Mouse. An unforgettable moment. Maybe you could play the congressional testimony on women in combat again, ? I loved hearing that. Yeah, General Barrow, you know, one of the sad things is that we didn't have as much video. Well, we didn't have too much of it. And so you don't, like that interview with Gene Sledge. I mean, we don't have stuff like that, very much of it. You know, General Barrow in long format, you know, giving his thoughts. And most of it, you know, is because it was so formal. You know, it's pretty scripted stuff. That's why the thing with Gene Sledge and Studs Terkel is so rare, because it's them kind of shooting the shit. So what we're going to do is on this birthday, we will only observe the birthday. And so I won't check the news. So we're going to take a break, and then you're going to hear one of my favorite interviews, and that is an interview that I did with Cal Humphrey. And he was a PFC on Iwo Jima, and so you're going to hear his story, which is very cool. So don't touch that dial. More Vol Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only Happy Birthday Home, All Marine Radio.
We used to get together every week. She's been home from her last deployment for months now, and I haven't seen her once.
He's just been different since he got back from Iraq. One minute he's ready to go, and the next he doesn't want anyone around.
The nightmares are back and seem to be getting worse. Shouldn't he be sleeping better after all these years?
A lot of people don't understand what veterans go through during their service or when they come back, and that's okay.
But everyone can help.
You can make a difference in the life of a veteran.
You stood by us when we were in uniform, so stand by us now.
Like my brother did, when he wouldn't take no for an answer.
Like my wife did, when she asked the right questions.
Like my friend did, when she made the call.
Take a stand for those who served our country.
If you're a veteran in crisis, or know one who is, the confidential Veterans Crisis Line is here for you. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Chat at veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255.
America's service members and veterans are strong, forged out of bravery, sacrifice, and duty. They are diverse, unique, from all corners of the country, and thanks to their common experience, a family for life. But whether they served in lands far away or communities close to home, some of these men and women may face difficult times or even crisis. But sometimes reaching out for help can be the most challenging and worthwhile mission of all for veterans, service members, reserve, and National Guard. Thankfully, friends, family, and communities are standing by their service members and veterans now more than ever. We're all in this together. When you recognize something isn't right, make the call to the Veterans Crisis Line or Military Crisis Line. During times of crisis, reach out and call. Dial 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 or chat online at veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255.
Hi, I'm Gary Sinise. Our veterans put everything on the line to protect our freedom. We may never be able to repay them for their sacrifice, but we can show them just how much we appreciate all they've done. You can help by simply sharing your time, lending a warm smile, a supportive hand, or a sympathetic ear to someone who needs it. Everyone can do something to make veterans know just how much we appreciate their service. Please visit www.volunteer.va.gov. What will you do?
We all share a common journey. We wanted to serve our country, stand for something bigger than ourselves, and protect the things we love. Although we were ready to face any mission, help those in need, and make a difference, for some of us, coming home was more of a challenge than we expected. In the service, we had each other's backs. But as veterans, it can sometimes feel like we're all alone, even when surrounded by our loved ones.
If you're a veteran or service member in crisis, or know one who is, call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Chat at veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
So, I don't know how I met Jess Humphrey. I met Jess Humphrey when I was working at One Man. His uncle, he was telling me about his uncle and his father fought on Iwo Jima. Jeff's father is a pretty influential guy in Marine Corps history. And the concepts of his were used during the Cold War in Vietnam and also in Europe. And they all centered around respect, treating other cultures with respect, and then taking that respect and leveraging that into influence. And so we had a number of conversations about, you know, Jess would talk about, you know, the work his dad did and the house that they grew up in. And they all learned how to box because that's how his dad taught it. Boxing was a great equalizer. It taught respect. Didn't matter if you won or lost. It mattered if you fought, right? It mattered how you treated your opponent with respect. So anyway, I think one day I said, hey, would your uncle come on All Marine Radio and talk about his experience on Iwo Jima? And he said, well, I'll ask him. So he came on, and honestly, one of the coolest interviews I've ever done. And, you know, you get a glimpse into, you know, Marines who fought in World War II. They came from very, very humble origins. Most had, not most, all. I mean, so let's just say you're 20 in 1945. You're born in 1945. You're born in 1925. In 1929, the stock market crashes, and throughout the decade of the 30s, right, the American experience is the Depression. And the other thing going on is the Dust Bowl. The Dust Bowl goes from 1930 to 1936, a period of severe dust storms that greatly damaged the ecology and agriculture of the American and the Canadian prairies during the 30s. Severe drought and winds and a failure to apply dry land farming methods to prevent wind erosion caused this phenomenon, right? We're largely insulated from now, if not completely insulated now. But they weren't in 1930. So that was the culture that, you know, you came from the Depression. You came from, if you were in the Midwest, you came from the Dust Bowl. And wasn't real pretty. Cal grew up in the Midwest. And so, when I do these interviews, I don't know really where they're going to go. And I sit there like everybody else, just marveling at what I hear and trying to be not so, you know, I'm trying to do the interview in addition to being a geek about this stuff. Right. And so, so that is always the challenge when I get to interview somebody like this. And so this is Cal Humphrey, a PFC on Iwo Jima. I think he survives 26 days before he himself is wounded at the northern end of the island. I think when he was wounded, he had become a squad leader, and he was trying to talk to a tank on one of those phones that were on the back of the tank. Japanese saw the tank, and they immediately began to mortar it, and with Cal standing behind it, you know, and the mortars falling, he was hit. I mean, then the story is, I mean, where do you hear that part of it? He has to walk, you know, with part of his guts hanging out. He has to get himself to the battalion aid station, which he does. So, and he would tell you that, you know, although that may sound difficult, he was happy to have such a wound because others were not so fortunate. So anyway, on this birthday, here's somebody who's emblematic of our culture and our history. His name is Cal Humphrey.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. 7:34 here on a Thursday morning, 9:34 in the Midwest, where my guest is from. He is none other than Cal Humphrey. Cal, first of all, thanks for taking time out of your day and joining us here on All Marine Radio.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, that's awesome. What do you, first of all, we need to learn about you, okay, so we can know if we can take you seriously. You're born and raised where?
Well, I'll tell you what, I got my discharge out so I could remember myself what the hell happened to me. I was born in Emporia, Kansas, in 1925, and then we moved to St. Joe, Missouri. The folks moved to St. Joe, Missouri. I was just a child, and that's where I grew up pretty well. We really moved to Mountain City. We did a little town north of St. Joe, but we grew up in that area.
And how many brothers and sisters?
I had two sisters and two brothers.
So five families and a kid, that's a respectable number, right?
Well, back in the 30s, that was kind of a small family.
You know what I was going to say? In the 50s, in the 60s, we had four. And I looked at my mom and dad like, well, what's wrong? Why? The Seymours have eight.
Yeah.
The Demers, they have 11. Like, what the hell? Four? Are you kidding me? Are you guys?
Yeah. That's kind of like we were, you know, we were the smallest probably in the area. There was 8, 9, 10, even up to 15. And the hell of it was most of us lived in two-room houses with no lights, no electricity, no water, no running water, you know.
How did that work?
Well, it worked fine. We didn't know any difference. I think I was 15 before I got into a house that had electricity and running water. That's when we moved down to St. Joe from Mountain City.
Where'd you sleep? You got five.
Well, hell, you generally had two bedrooms and a kitchen, maybe a little bitty old living room.
Right.
And you always filled the bedrooms with beds, and the girls slept with, and the mom and dad and the boys all slept in one bed, you know.
Fighting.
Back then, it's pretty cold. You're happy to have a couple guys with you.
All right. So, how does the Marine Corps get on your radar from Missouri?
Well, you know, we were back in World War II. You know, nobody thought about not going.
Right.
Everybody. I mean, it was just a fact. You were going to go to service.
All right, hold on. Let me stop you. First of all, where were you on December 7th? What were you doing?
I was in school in Lee Summit, Missouri. I was down there. I wasn't living at home. I was working for a farmer down in Lee Summit, Missouri.
How old were you?
I was 17.
17. You're working, going to school, and on that Sunday morning, did you go to church? Were you a church-going kid, or what were you doing?
Well, I was a church-going kid till I got big enough to sneak off and go fishing.
So you were fishing that morning?
No, I was probably milking cows.
All right. And so when you heard about it, as you just said, nobody thought about not going. Everybody was going to go do their part. Did you know anything about the Marine Corps at that time in your life?
I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps, and we didn't pay much attention to the war. You know, we were just living. It really wasn't like these wars now where you get, you know, you all got radios and every damn thing, and you hear everything that's going on, you know.
Right.
We didn't hear hardly anything. Unless something really bad happened, there'd be a little article in the paper about it or something like that, you know. But we didn't sit around and watch television, and but most people didn't have them. You didn't have television back then.
Wow.
I got my first television. I went to come back from the service and went to farming. And I bought the first television in that farming area. It was a little bitty old thing, you know. I'd sit there and look at that just amazed how they could put that picture on that thing. But see, back then we didn't get the news like you get it now, you know. When 15 minutes after somebody gets shot overseas, we hear about it.
Right.
We didn't have that news. We didn't have that news cycle that we got now.
Yeah, that's not a good thing either, I don't think. My guest this morning from the great state of Nebraska is Cal Humphrey. And Cal's nephew, Jess, is a colleague of mine. I'd like to call him a friend, but I'm very careful who I call friends there. Cal, but he was a member of the Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, on the volcanic island of Iwo Jima. He's gracious enough to join us this morning, and we're talking about where he was prior to the war. So December 7th rolls around, and then how the hell did he get in the Marine Corps?
Well, I'll tell you what, they just put me in the Marine Corps.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I wasn't, it says here I was 66 and a quarter inches tall, so that was a 5'7". And I probably weighed about 130. So I think the Marines were needing people.
they were needing people. Holy smokes. So 130 pounds at 5'6". Holy smokes. So they tell you you're going to be a Marine. And what'd you say? Okay.
Hell, I didn't know anything about it. Yeah. Okay.
And so then where did they send you?
Well, they sent me to boot camp in San Diego, and I think that's about a month. And then we went to that line camp up there, Pendleton.
Right.
And we were there for a few months, and then we went to Hawaii, and we spent most of our time in Hawaii up there on the King Ranch up there in the desert, training.
Right. And now this
and
is about,
we had a lot of training.
And this is, hey, Cal, this is 1942?
It was three, wasn't it? Four, three or four.
40, okay, all right.
Yeah.
And then, and so you're in Hawaii, and now you're training with the 5th Division?
Yeah, the 5th Division, 27th Marines.
All right. And that that gets made, for people that are familiar with it, what a lot of Carlson's Raiders, a lot of Paramarines made up that. That was a pretty that was a pretty experienced group that you walk into.
Absolutely. I think that's why they put them in there, because all of them came in. I think they made them all sergeants and corporals and things like that, because all of our squad leaders were from that group, you know, that was with Carlson's Raiders.
What were they like? What were they like to train with? So you report, you're fresh off the street. You go to boot camp, and now these guys have been fighting for a while. What were they like to work with?
They were great guys. They were great guys. They had been, you know, they'd been through the ranks. They knew everything. They weren't up there, you know, like when you went to boot camp. You know, those guys were jerks, but these guys were really good guys, and they knew everything, and they weren't trying to show off. They taught me an awful lot, and I had several friends of them that were really good friends of mine. In fact, I had, you know, my platoon sergeant was really a good friend of mine.
What's his name?
What's his name?
Yep.
Yes, you shouldn't ask me.
You told me Les Jenks.
Yeah, a real good friend. In fact, he stopped. He was coming. His folks were owned a mortuary in New York, and he retired. When he came, him and his wife were going to California, and they stopped there and spent a couple of days with me in Omaha.
How long ago was that?
Oh, God, that's been a long time ago, probably 12 years, 13 years. 14 years. I know I've been here 29 years, so it's been a long time.
All right.
So when you get my age, you know, I'll be 91 next month. When you get my age, names and dates and times kind of go by the wayside.
That's a long time to, like, have to remember. That's like a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's like, it's when you're young, you don't have to remember that much stuff. But as you get older, there's a lot of stuff that you got to remember.
Well, I can still remember stuff I did when I was 4 or 5 years old, but a lot of times I have a little hard time remembering what I did yesterday.
Yeah, trust me, I'm with you. I think Jess told me that John Bazelone was in your battalion.
John Bazelone was in the 28th.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I knew
John. Yeah, he was in the 28th.
How did you know him?
Oh, I see him up Flop Chute, you know. You know, back then, you know, they had those slop shoots on the where you could just go up and you get beer for 15 cents or something. A lot of people went up there every night. John was there quite a bit, and I talked to him quite often.
Tell us about him.
He got nutty. You know, he got that award. Right. And when we went into Evil, I think he thought he was going to do the same thing. Well, hell, he got shot right off the bat.
Right. Right. The what kind of guy was he? I mean,
I thought he was a pretty nice guy. You know, well, of course, we was all about that snockered when we were together, but right. I thought he was a fine guy.
Really? The so you do your training, and then what's the most memorable thing in terms of either what you learned or in training from the group of guys that comprised, you know, your NCOs and the leadership of the 27th Marines? What's the number one thing they taught you?
Well, they just taught you a world of stuff, you know, how to take care of yourself and try not to be a hero, but do your job. And they were pretty good. But the hell of it was, they didn't last very long. Most of them were killed in the 34th day on Iwo. In fact, our lieutenant was killed. The first one we had. Wouldn't get. We were all about six of us in a big shell hole there, and he wouldn't get out of it when we left. When we had to leave, had to go on across that field. And,
so he was a smart guy.
Yeah, and then the next one we got lasted about a day and a half. I didn't even hardly get to see him, and then we didn't get any more. We didn't have any more lieutenants all the way through when I was there.
All right. I have an email for you, and if you have a question or comment, you can send a text message to 714-661-8107. You can send an email to live.allmarineradio@gmail.com, or you can call if you want to ask Cal a question yourself. 714-884-4294. The question says this: Mac, where did 27th Marines land on the morning of D-Day? So,
well, we had the beaches were, you know, like colored, like red, white. We landed on red.
All right. And red was so the closest to Suribachi was Green Beach. That's what's 28th Marines, right?
That's where they landed. We all the first wave, which I was on, landed in Amtrak. And, you know, they ran us up on the beach as far as they could go.
Right.
And then we bailed out of the damn things, and that beach was, you know, that's all volcanic ash. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
yeah, absolutely.
It's soft and tough to walk in and run in, and we got in pretty good. We got up next to the bank, and then the Higgins boats started coming in. Of course, then the all hell broke loose, you know. That was a devastating thing there, but for the first 2 or 3 hours.
Let's talk about that, Cal. So you guys were in track vehicles, and you're off the coast, and the Navy's plastering that, and the Navy and Marine Corps Air are hitting the island. What were your thoughts as you were headed to the shore?
Well, I was manning a 50 caliber machine gun on that Amtrak, and so I was standing up where I could see everything. And there wasn't any airplanes. It was all naval.
Naval guns.
Yeah, and you couldn't even see the island. And, you know, it takes you a long time to get in. Those tracks don't go very fast. You know, you get out there, you all load up, and then you run around in a circle, everybody gets lined up, and the time you lined up, division's going to hit the beach, you know. Crush, you got people lined up for a mile.
Right.
And then, so we get in, and they take us up on the beach as far as they can, and then the Higgins boats start coming in, and of course, they quit shelling it.
Right.
But then the aircraft came in and started bombing it.
Okay.
The Navy aircraft, small ones.
Right.
And then when all hell broke loose, you know, from the Japanese. And of course, they had that island all gridded off, and with their, so they were very effective. They just killed the hell out of the guys. You couldn't even hardly see the back. When you look back, you couldn't see anything part of the dead guys. And they had a lot of boats out in the water. And
right.
It was a really I don't know. I think we probably lost an awful lot of people. I don't know any numbers or anything like that, but just the looking, it was terrible.
Right.
So, and our mission was to go straight across the island, across the airfield to the other side, and right. The 28th was to go and turn and go and take Sarabachi.
Okay.
They took that in about 3 days, I think, because I remember seeing a little flag put up there about the second or third day, I can't remember what, this little bitty old thing. Then they had the big ceremony, you know, where they got a big flag up there and took the picture.
Matt, can you believe that after 70 years they finally identified the right people in the picture here in the last
week? I can believe that. You know, it was a confusing situation over there, no matter what you did, you know.
Right.
So I can believe they were all up there, and he was trying to gather up a bunch of guys to put that flag up. You know, he needed about two. What did he get, six of them?
Six.
And to make a picture, and it turned out to be great for him.
Yeah, a hell of a picture.
It sure was.
But
I can believe they could have made a mistake, because there was probably 6-18 guys standing around watching, you know.
Yeah, and they were up there for a while. Do you remember? Did you see the first flag go up? Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, no, I didn't see it go up. It wasn't very high. It was only about 3-4 feet high. And it looked like somebody carried up in their pack or something. You know,
right.
Just a little one.
But
I told the guy. Remember, we were starting to go the other way, but we were still getting some fire off Sarabachi, you know, some rifle fire. And I remember we turned around and looked at that flag, and I said, well, we won't have to watch our asses anymore. It looks like they've taken that hill.
Just to answer the emailer, if you look at where 1st Battalion 27th Marines is on Red Beach, it goes from the south, adjacent to Sarabachi. 28th Marines is on Green Beach. Then there's Red 1, which is 2nd Battalion, 27th Marines. Red 2 is further north, and that's where the 1st Battalion, 27th Marines lands. And it's probably right at the base of airfield number 1. So there's a gap between airfield number 1 and Sarabachi. That's kind of 2nd Battalion, 27th Marines, and then 28th Marines. 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, it looks like you guys headed right across the southern end of the airfield to the far side.
And we were supposed to go clear across that airfield, the far side. And the far side, you didn't go to the water. There was a great big, looked like 20-acre depression there that was kind of sea level. You know, you go down another bank So that's as far as we went. We didn't go down in that depression there. And then we turned and went up the island.
So you're this is your first time in combat, Cal. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you remember as you got on the island, what the hell is going through your mind as you see, you know, you're involved, you don't know it yet, but you're involved in one of the greatest battles of World War II and certainly in Marine Corps history. What were your thoughts as you were,
well, you
as
know,
you were coming off the beach?
You know, you're so dumb, I guess. I really wasn't all that frightened till we got on up there, and you know, then when you get into these battles and you get mortared, you know. Crush, we lay in those goddamn foxholes and get to shaking. Our teeth would bump, and your flesh would even twitch. You know, you'd be so goddamn scared. You'd be terrified.
Right.
But when you got out, you kind of laugh at each other and go on. But it's a terrifying thing. And some guys get scared. They just lay there like babies. They couldn't. They had their rifles so tight you couldn't hardly get them out of their hands, and their teeth would be, you know, just like they're going to pop, their mouth and be so tight. But it was a terrifying thing. But the first day didn't seem to bother me too much, because I was too dumb to know what the hell was going on, I guess. But even with the guys dying, you know, we all kept toilet paper in our helmets. You know, when we go on these,
right.
We did that back in the States. when we go on, when we go out. I remember looking up there when I was on the beach and I see that toilet paper flipping down. I thought, oh my God, somebody's head blew off. But it's enough to make people go nutty in a fruitcake, you know. That first day didn't seem to, I just didn't know what the hell was going on, I guess. I suppose you're just kind of numb.
When you think about that first day, do you have a lasting memory? One thing you remember, anything more than other things on the first day?
Well, I remember we had a foxhole right up in front of us, right on top of the hill there. It was a cement dome thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the Jinx said, we've got to take that damn thing out. We can't get over. But it did have some cracks in it where I guess the bombs done something to it. And he sent a couple of the older guys, crawled up there and got a flamethrower in it. So we got by that obstacle in pretty good shape, and we got back up on the airport, and it was just littered with big holes. It was, hell, some of them was 6-7 foot deep, you know, and 15-20 foot across. I don't know what kind of bombs made those. But
big bombs.
They were good for us. Because we could kind of hopscotch from those from one to the next and get across there. We didn't have to dig any foxholes going across that airport. We just kind of moved out, crawled around, and got over.
And you guys got to the far side? And did you get to the far side on day one?
We got there in about day two, I think it was.
Okay.
Pretty well. Day one, we didn't do too much. We had a lot of snipers. There were some snipers out on that airfield in some of those holes, and there was, I know there was a plane, looked like an old plane that had been scrapped or something. There was a sniper in. They did get a half track up there and blast it out of there. That's when we got out, our hole moved on out. And I remember they told us on the out in the ocean, they said, well, they didn't think the Japs had any guns on there to do anything bad to their tanks, you know. Well, right. Hell, the first tank that went up above us just got blown to hell. I said, well, that settles that.
I guess that answers that.
Yeah.
Maybe they do have an anti-tank gun up there.
I think they convinced those tank guys today too, because that first one went up.
My guess this morning is Cal Humphreys. He a member of 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, Alpha Company, as it were, and landed on Iwo Jima in 1945. And we're talking about the landing. I've got another email question. Mac, how did, as a young guy, his first battle, he said he wasn't that scared that day, but I'm sure that he's, given the death he saw on the beach, it had to make an incredible impression on him. Did he just put it out of his mind and keep going because that's what he had to do? You saw stuff that you'd probably never seen in your life that day. How did you deal with it in your head?
I think everybody dealt with it the same way. I think it was just awesome. You were just there, you know. You were just there. I don't think probably your mind wasn't there altogether, but you had a few things to do that kept you busy. We had to keep moving out, try to move out. Of course, and you could hear those goddamn bullets whizzing by you, and then they were still shelling the beach and shooting mortars at the beach. The thing that really saved a lot of us was those mortars went down in that pretty deep in that ash before they went off, which probably saved a hell of a lot of guys.
So if it would have been normal dirt and they would have been surface bursting mortars.
Yeah, the explosion would have been terrible.
Right.
We might not have got on there.
Wow.
But it, I can't explain it. I guess your mind kind of does something to you. I mean, what can you do? You can't panic and run back out in the ocean, and you goddamn sure don't want to run ahead. So you just kind of stay there with everybody else and there wasn't anybody to shoot at.
Yeah, how did that piss you off? All this stuff's going on, and there's nobody to shoot at. What the hell?
Well, you just, that's what I say. You just don't know what the hell to do. You couldn't dig a foxhole on that crap.
So you kept following Jenks.
Well, you just.
I hope
was like us. He didn't go very far either.
I hope Jenks knows what he's doing because I'm behind him. Now, you and I were talking the other day, and I said, "What was the secret to you were wounded on what deep plus 19?"
I think so, something like that.
Okay, and I asked you what was the secret to that, and you said never be the first one out of the fighting position.
Well, you need to look around a little. But we were all pretty careful, but still a hell of a lot of us got killed.
Wow. All right. There wasn't any safe place.
When you got up there and you had to go back and replace people, you know, you can't do that hardly on the front line. So it was worse back there than it was on the front line because you had a company back there digging in. And, hell, that island was, you could see pretty well everywhere. Those guys were a little on the high ground compared to when from the airports, you know.
Right.
Christ, you just get the poop mortared out of you. It didn't last very long, 15, 20 minutes, and then our guys would find out where they were and start throwing mortars back, you know, and get it stopped. But 10, 15 minutes, mortars flying all around you is scary.
That'll piss you off. You know how long?
Now
we have a radar beam that we shoot across the ground, and when they shoot something at us, it breaks the radar where it goes up, and it breaks it where it comes down, and then we get the exact grid that they shot it from. So
that has helped us to beat hell because it generally probably took our guys a 10, 15 minutes to
see it, right?
Locate them.
Yeah, they had to see it.
Uh-huh.
Which means they got to see enough shots to find that thing. What the hell is it? Oh, it's over there. Well, now, you can imagine that. Let me tell you how it works now, Cal. We'll have one of those drones flying overhead,
uh-huh.
And we have this, it's called counter-battery radar, you know, laid out across an area, let's say Fallujah or Ramadi in Iraq, and then they shoot. And as soon as that thing comes back down and breaks the plane the second time, you get the point of impact, you get the point of origin, and then you very quickly take the point of origin and you send it by computer to the guy running the drone. He takes the camera, and the drone goes right to that grid, and here they are standing there.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, in less than 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then guess what happens at about 4 minutes into it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Only thing I thought they did wrong is bomb. They used bombs. It. I always told Les. I said if we can get these guys to drop napalm, we'll be in good shape. But these damn bombs don't. They can't get anybody in any caves. They can't really hit those pillboxes. I said unless they're lucky.
So napalm. Explain why napalm was effective.
Oh hell! They'd drop that stuff in there. It spread for a long ways, and it cook them. It even gets hot, you know, and go in the mouths of those caves and stuff like that. But if they'd have dropped napalm on that island, they'd have probably hurt somebody. But all that other crap, I don't think it hurt anybody worth a damn. Breached a few pillboxes, but I don't think killed very many people.
All right. Now, Cal, I've got to take about a two-minute break. Can you hold on, and we'll continue our discussion?
You betcha.
All right. From Omaha, Nebraska. Is it Calvin?
Calvin.
Calvin. That's kind of a Baptist name, isn't it?
Yep, probably.
Calvin Humphrey. He's the uncle of a good friend of mine, Jess Humphrey, and he's gracious enough to join us here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Water Radio Network. We're going to take about a two-minute break. We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion about what it was like to fight on Iwo Jima. More of that coming up next.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Five minutes after 8 o'clock here on a Thursday morning. And privileged this morning to be joined by a veteran of the Battle of Iwo Jima. His name is Cal Humphrey. And a member of the 27th Marine Regiment, Alpha Company, which makes him part of the 1st Battalion. And we continue our discussion and kind of talk about the first day, Cal. I got a couple emails, so let me ask them. Mac, early in the battle, what killed the most Marines? Was it indirect fire, mortars? Was it machine guns? Cal?
I think it probably was the mortars and shells.
Okay.
There was a lot of bullets flying around, but I don't. You hear them whistling by, you know, like kind of make a sound when they go by you. But I couldn't answer that question. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Next question.
And some parts of the beach was a lot different than others, you know.
Right. Right. No, I mean, it's very interesting as you read different accounts of the battle, how different it is depending on where you were.
Sure.
Next question is, Mac, how did those guys sleep? It seems like when you read about the battle, they operated almost what would seem to be 24 hours a day because of the Japanese threat being all around them. How the hell did they sleep?
You had two men to a foxhole, two men. One was supposed to be awake all the time. We had to be conscious of that banzai crap, you know, they pull everywhere.
Right.
Every night. So we had the Navy shot flares. That island was never dark. It was, you know how a flare is, it kind of, you can just see. And, so we'd set our grenades up, we'd set our machine guns up, we'd set our 37 millimeter guns in their line with the canister ammunition. Spread out our BAR men, because we didn't know when this band was going to come, early in the morning or night or what the hell ever.
Right.
And that's one guy was supposed to sleep and the other guy was supposed to stay awake, which hell never happened. You know, we both went to sleep. But hopefully there's enough guys somewhere around in the line that wake up and start shooting, wake you all up. And we killed, at the end of the thing, we killed a lot of Japs at night, one at a time. I don't know whether we're looking for ammunition or water or, you know, walking around out there. And my guys, when I was took over the squad, we killed one the last night before I got hit. I told the guys, I had two recruits with me because they were just got them that day. And I said, I want you guys to aim, and I want you to don't shoot till I tell you, because I want this son of a buck to get up close enough we can kill him. I don't want to wound him after they're throwing grenades at us. So we got him done. But a lot of these guys listening to this might think that old guy's nutty or fruitcake. You know, you keep hearing all the time these people don't want to talk about you ever hear that? You know, you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, he came home and never said a word.
Well, I told one of my boys, you know, he said, well, Dad, you never ever talk about it. I said, let me tell you something. What am I going to say to you? I come home and see your mom and say, Mom, I just spent a month without taking a bath or changing my clothes and ate K-rations every day. And I did brush my teeth once in a while. I thought I was going to have enough water, but I had to use the same toothbrush I cleaned my rifle with.
Who the hell
wants to hear that crap?
How'd that taste?
it wasn't too bad. And then you run out of toilet paper, you gotta wipe your butt with your hand and clean it off. I said, one thing we did have, we had that volcanic ash clean your hand up pretty good.
Does it? Well, they use it in a lot of soaps now, right?
I said, you can't talk about that kind of stuff, and you damn sure can't talk about people getting blown up and getting their arms blown off and sitting in a foxhole with some poor bastard bleeding to death. You can't do anything for him but give him a morphine shot. And you can't, I said, this isn't the movies. You can't call a corpsman because, first place, they probably couldn't hear you, and you wouldn't want to have somebody have to get up and get killed getting to you. And if he was smart, he wouldn't get up. So I said, it's just horrible. I hear these wanting to put these girls into combat. It's probably like you say. It's probably nothing like we went through. So maybe these girls can handle the front lines, but they can't handle the front lines like those boys had to in World War One. No matter where you are, whether you're in the Pacific, or you're in the Navy, you get in Europe, you just
I don't think they can do it, to be honest with you, Cal. I mean, you know, you might be able to do it back here, but you know that.
Yeah, they couldn't do it, and you wouldn't want them to do it. For Christ's sake, who wants to take our national treasures and put them on the front line?
Yeah, no, and again, but you know what, Marines will handle it. You know, it's just like if you had a weak guy, what do you do with him? He's going to go work in the office, he'll be the company driver, he'll do this, he'll do that. They'll find something for him because there's not that many women that'll do it. And quite frankly, and you know, we're having an interesting discussion about that the other day. It's like, so a squad leader, somebody gets confused, what's a squad leader do? He grabs them and throws them.
Yep.
Right? And he didn't have time to talk. Hey, go. And
no.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. They just can't. I'll tell you what I carried. I had that M1, you know, was loaded that weighs about 9 pounds.
M1 Garand, right.
I had a 20-pound of explosive, and I always carried competition C2. I had 3 concussion grenades, and then I carried a phosphorus grenade because I like to throw those. And then you got probably 4 or 5 clips or 6 or 7, however scared you were, you know.
Right.
And you had, had your other little crap you're supposed to have with you, you know. You had your canteen, your bayonet, and your K-bar and all that crap. A woman can't do that.
Yeah, well, let me tell you.
Unless they're just tougher than hell. They got, well, I shouldn't say that. A lot of them could.
Well,
some of the guys couldn't.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. But, you
couldn't carry a flamethrower. It weighed about 60 pounds. Hell, I tried it. I couldn't even get 10 steps.
With the flamethrower?
And even if I could, I'd have said I couldn't. Those things get you killed.
Listen to this. This is written by a Marine Corps Sergeant Major who was involved in the testing that the Marine Corps did with female Marines, and who all, you know, by every account, you know, did their best and are good Marines. It's just not an easy task. He says this: the best women in the Ground Combat Integration Task Force as a group in regard to infantry operations were equal to or below, in most cases, the lowest 5% of men in the group in the test study. So that was the best woman is equal to or below the lowest 5% of guys. Okay, now, so what does that tell you? That tells you that it's hard work, and, you know, the weaker guys struggle to do it, and, you know, I'd say, and that's what the test says, that the lowest 5%.
And he is right, because we had some of them, and we had some that couldn't do anything. One of the guys, there was 2 guys in my platoon, Les Yanks, the sergeant, and a kid, don't say his name, but a kid from Chicago, that I don't think he walked a step on Iwo Jima. He was damn near crawled everywhere. And he wasn't worth a damn. I don't think he probably even fired his rifle.
Wow.
And I'll tell you something else probably nobody would realize, maybe like in other areas it was different. I saw very, very few Japs. Very few.
So how did you, okay, so.
It was all digging them out, blowing them out, covering them up, sealing up the caves. And you'd see if, I told Les one day, I said, you know, Les, we've lost over half of our platoon, and we haven't visibly seen kill over 7 or 8 or 9 Japs. You know, when we blow up a pillbox, we'd get them all, or, you know, or some little structure they had built. But the ones in the cave, you might see 1 or 2 in the door, and then you'd throw a phosphorus grenade in there and then seal the damn thing up. But I said, we're not, if these guys are moving backwards, when we get to the end of this island, it's just going to be all people.
Right. Well, let me ask you about that. I have an email that says, Mac, I'm looking at a map of the battle, and 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, goes across the island, and then they turn towards the northern end of the island.
Right.
And they run in to the eastern side of Hill 362 Alpha, which was built like a fortress.
Right.
Tell us about the thing. I've seen pictures and diagrams of that thing. They turned the mountain into a pillbox.
structure they had into a pillbox, every little structure. And there was, back when you got on the big end of the island, there was a lot of those, not like that hill,
right,
but like half as big and two-thirds as big. And they all had caves in them. They all had, oh, God, they had everything, every place. That guy that ran that island, that Japanese commander set that island up, he was a genius.
Kiribati.
Yeah, he was really he must have been the best officer they had in the whole Japanese army, because they did never do anything foolish. They never ever showed themselves. So he had them extremely well trained, I guess. I don't know, but it was kind of like fighting ghosts, you know. You knew where they were, and you knew damn well they're out there because they're killing you. But you damn sure couldn't see too many of them.
Kyle Humphrey, my guest here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. We're talking about the Battle of Iwo Jima. And, Kyle, the other thing about Hill 362, which is what you're talking about, is not only was it the hill itself that was, you know, fortified, but all the terrain that surrounded it, you know, that ringed it, was shooting as you tried to close with the hill. You know, Marines were getting shot in the back, were getting shot in the side from, you know, from the cliffs off to your right as you were moving to the north. And then from, you know, on the northern side, on the far side of Hill 362, the terrain, that there's a hill that goes up kind of behind it, you know, that dominated the approaches to it. So it was, you read about just getting to it, to get to it. You had to fight to do that. And it just, you know, the tactical problem that he put in front of you guys, as you said, he's a smart guy and absolutely brutal in terms of what it cost you guys in terms of casualties.
Yeah. Well, when we got over to that edge of that island, you know, like I told you, we didn't go down in that big swale.
Right.
It was quite a swale there. We went right around that, and when we come to the hill 362, see, we stayed on this side of it and went on around that curve, and that little depression was behind us.
Right.
And we were getting some shots from the rear, and I looked down there. They had a trench all the way up, a kind of a berm all the way across that thing, and it had gaps in it. And they had holes they were shooting at us from back down there and from on top. And we could walk probably had 12, 15 feet we could walk if we stayed up close to that bank. But if you got 2 foot out of that, you got shot. I had a good friend with me, Red. His name was Red Cole. And I said, now, Red, don't get up there. Don't get up there. Stay down here. Damn if he didn't walk up there, and damn if he didn't get shot. Right through the side, went in one side and out the other, and I grabbed him and pulled him back down by me, and he said, I can't feel my feet. I said, ah, you'd probably be all right, Red. You just hurt. But we had to leave him. They you just stick a rifle up. If they're alive, you don't put a helmet on top of it. If they're dead, you stick their rifle in the ground and put a helmet on top of it. But the litter bearers, hell, they couldn't keep up. They took mostly the live guys, and the dead guys a lot of time left and laid around for a day or two. But we finally took that. But that devastated, pretty well devastated our company. We had I don't know, they trained us, you know, to walk in single file and leave distance between us. And you know how guys are, right, Christ, right. If there's a little jump they have to jump over, pretty soon they're all bunched up in front of it. We did lose one complete full platoon just right off the bat there. And from then on out, well, we kind of was a little bit more careful how we did things, you know, one complete squad.
My guest this morning, Cal Humphrey, he a PFC when you went ashore. And when did you become a squad leader?
I became a squad leader about the last week, and only because I was one of the, there was three of us left, a guy by the name of Groneman, and me and a corporal. And we were up in those hills, and we were walking down through we had about a 20-foot canyon we had to go through, and the bottom of it was all eroded out, and they came to a little wall in front of it. It was about, 5.5-foot wall. Well, you know how you do when you, we had all new guys, but three of us, damn, they didn't all crowd up in there, you know, right behind that wall. And I was bringing up the rear, and there was a cave on one side of it, and pretty soon grenades started coming over that wall, and guys started shooting out of that cave, and Jesus Christ, it was a mess. And I did finally get up there and kill a couple guys in the cave, threw a grenade in there, and threw a couple over the bench, but it was just, you just didn't have anybody. The groomer got killed right off the bat. And that was, we got a lot of medals over there in that island because the officers were so close, they could see damn near all the combats, you know. They could see all these firefights.
Right.
And I got a Silver Star for that little episode, which wasn't anything but a bunch of bullshit because that kind of stuff happened every day.
it sounds like it is. Well, I got another email for you, Cal. Mac, as Cal looks at the battle, what was the most difficult part of the battle in his opinion?
Well, the I guess the worst part was, you know, when you had an objective, you just had to move out and you had to take whatever you had to take, you know. And like you say, if they had a cave, they had it protected by a couple of pillboxes, you know, out to each side, and maybe some spider holes, and maybe another little bunker or two. But they were all pretty well tied in, so you just, if you attacked one, you got shot by the others. And that was really hard and really tough. But that didn't bother me near as bad as laying in a foxhole getting mortared or a shell hole. That's what damn near run me out of my mind. In fact, I told Les one time, I said, Les, I'd just soon stay up here. I'd just soon not go back.
Oh, yeah, as they rotated your platoon and company?
Well, you had to go. They rotated the company generally because you'd get up there and you might lose a platoon,
right,
half, and then you'd have to move another platoon up and lose some of them. Then you got to go back and get reinforcements. You can't get reinforcements up there, you know. Right. Damn, you got to go back.
Right.
It wasn't on account of ammunition or anything like that. We always had plenty of ammunition.
Just getting
short of water once in a while, but other than that, we had plenty of ammunition. And
all right, so the mortars are the things that used to piss you
off.
That's
what scared me, Landon. You knew damn well somebody was going to get. They're going to hit some of you.
Yeah. All right, another question for you, Mac. Did Cal use the same rifle throughout the battle? Those guys must have pumped a lot of rounds through those rifles. Did he wind up getting a new rifle at any point because he wore his out? I've read stories about that. The same rifle the whole time, Cal?
Yeah, same rifle. And to be right truthful with you, we didn't really shoot that much. If we saw anything, or if we saw a hole, or if we saw this, or we saw that, we shot. Or, like, if we were going up to, we had to take the flamethrower guys up. You know, three of us would go up before him and crawl up, and he would come up right behind us. And then we'd try to get us throw a few grenades and get a spot so we could get up there and put the flame in that hole of that cave or into the, and they shoot pretty far. Those flamethrowers are shoot 35, 40 feet, I think.
And that was forever on Iwo Jima, right? I mean, when most engagements are taking, you know, place less than 20 meters.
Oh, hell, they were terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. Yeah, when you got in close and you got the, if once in a while those Japs would run out of those pillboxes and you'd see them, you know. They knew they were going to get burned after a while.
Right.
So they'd get it up, but they very seldom ever came out of the caves. And we could seal those caves pretty easy.
I got another email for you. Mac, did after hearing that he was wounded on D-plus 19, that must have felt like an eternity in terms of time in close combat. Did he think he was going to get killed?
Everybody thought they were going to get killed, and that's what I told the recruits when they came up to me, the ones I had after I took the squad over. I told them, look, guys, now, the odds of getting out of here alive are just almost nil. So anytime you see something move, or you see a hole in the ground, or you see a hole anywhere or anything, shoot at it. Now, I don't give a goddamn, shoot your whole clip up. We've got a lot of ammunition, but shoot at it. And keep your goddamn heads down. Don't be getting up, messing around, and looking around and not paying attention. Look in all directions, but look forward. I did not wear out my rifle. No, it was, I left the damn thing.
Where did you, tell us how you got wounded.
Well, we were, B Company had got wrecked that day, and our captain said, well, we're going to have to go fill in that line. So my platoon had to go fill it in. And of course I was, Les said, you take your squad, Calalask, and go on down. You'll probably meet up with somebody down there on the end. Well, hell, we didn't meet up with anybody. I didn't see anybody for a quarter mile down there. So I told the guys, well, as far as we can go, so we'll just stay here. I'd seen where a tank had turned around, you know, and left a pretty good depression. And I said, we can dig in here a little bit and lay here in this tank track. And the next morning early, the tank came up. They must have called for it.
Okay.
And a guy popped out of the hood and he said, well, I'm looking for a target. And I said, well, you're the target, you dumb bastard. You're clear up here on the front line. I'll get on the phone and talk to you. So he got back in. I got up and walked around the back to grab that goddamn telephone. No more had it in my hand, and the mortar started falling. And it killed my two recruits. And I think I was, the one that got me was on the other side of the tank, because it just hit me in the upper body. And, of course, that tanky back, I didn't know this tank could burn rubber. If I'd been behind it, he'd have scorched me to death.
So you got hit. It hit
me pretty good, I couldn't hear for about a month and a half out of that one ear. But it got me all on my left side, but none in my legs or anything, so the tank had to be protecting me a little bit. And I busted a vial of smelling salts and thought, well, it's got to be a goddamn aid station around here somewhere if they had that big a battle yesterday. And I staggered back there and found one back there.
So you walked back under your own power to the
air?
Well,
I walked and crawled and sat and rested and smelled my smelling salts.
How long do you think it took you to get to the aid station?
Oh, you know, I don't have any idea. I don't know. Time just doesn't seem to make any difference to you when you're hurt. And I was hurt.
Well,
I had a couple of... Those Japanese must have had a lot of powder and not very much metal, because they put a lot of powder in their mortars, and they put a lot of powder in their grenades. And it busted them up into real small pieces.
Hmm.
And I had two pieces go in my chest. They left that in there.
Still got it? Still in there?
Yeah, still in there. And I had a piece, two pieces go through my helmet and stuck between my skin and my scalp. And a piece went through my arm, and then I had a pretty good piece hit me kind of on the chest there and dug a teacup full of meat out of there.
Teacup.
And I just, you know, and I think the concussion probably was what hurt my ear.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes you a little bit nutty, so you just don't know how to, I went the right way probably.
In your case, nuttier, right?
Yeah, nuttier.
So, well, Cal, look, first of all, I've got one more question for you, and then we'll let you go. But can we do this again sometime? Can I give you a call when you come back on? Because there's a lot of lessons that we have to learn from you, and we kind of heard the story for the first time. So I'd love to talk to you some more, but I've got one more question for you, and then
okay.
All right. What makes a good Marine?
Well, I think a guy that can kind of keep his common sense. You know, the first thing they want to preach to you and get in your head that you're 10 foot tall and bulletproof, and you're not. So those guys that know what they can do and what they can't do, and still keep their goddamn common sense instead of waving that flag all over hell, makes a good Marine.
So don't lose your common sense.
No.
And know that you can be just as dead as anybody else out here.
Absolutely, and everybody else in the service is just as good as you are. A lot of them proved. A lot of them came back from being on leave and the weekends and found out that those Army boys were just as tough as they were.
in spite of everything you saw in the movie.
Title of all you see in the movies.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, Cal. First of all, I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on the program here. I've read about Iwo Jima and the battle. I think as a lot of Marines have most of my military career and stand in awe of guys like you who went over and fought that fight on a daily basis. And you know, and I can't tell you what it's been, what a thrill it's been for me to have you on. And I am going to, hey, I don't give a shit if you tell me, yeah, don't ever call me again. I don't care if you say that. I'll call you and bug you and drag you back on this program.
Yeah, this doesn't bother me much. I'll lay awake a night or two, but then I'll get over in a hurry.
Did you have very many mental problems when you came home? I mean, we call
it. Never had any, but I'll tell you what I did. I didn't go to any conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't belong to the goddamn place where they all went up, you know, got drunk with those. Everybody joined those.
The Legion and the VFW?
Legions, you know, American
right.
Legion.
Right.
I joined and sent them my money, and I still do, but I don't go in the joint. And I don't go, you know, I don't go talking war talk to everybody. I just forgot it and left them alone. And I just had two buddies that I visited once in a while when I went to Phoenix. They both lived there. And that was my, the limit of what I did about it. Now, I don't think I didn't dream about it a hell of a lot, but I'd get up and read a book or something. I didn't lay there and suffer. So I got along great.
So you came and came home and tried to get as far as you, away from it as you could.
Just didn't want to be involved in any of that crap.
Interesting. All right, sir. Thank you very much today.
Okay. Well.
And we're going to do it again in the not too distant future. So.
All right, that'll be fine.
All right.
Okay. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye. That is Cal Humphreys from Unbelievable. Right, unbelievable story of life on Iwo Jima, and you know, you hear his perspective. They teach you that you're 10 feet tall, but you can be just as dead as everybody else. We're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna continue a discussion we had yesterday we're headed for the Chosen Reservoir. Don Bennett's gonna join us here in a minute. More of All Marine Radio. Coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio. Yeah, Iwo Jima to the Chosen. Come on, are you kidding me? This is a dream come true job. I keep saying that every day, but it is. More of that coming up next.
And that'll do it on on this Tuesday, the 10th day of November, here on a Tuesday edition, a birthday edition of All Marine Radio. If you're just tuning in, what you'll hear in the first hour is birthday ball talk. You hear the commandant's address, his message, and so you will hear that. And then what you just concluded listening to is Cal Humphrey. And he was PFC on Iwo Jima, born in the Midwest. Grew up in the combination of the Dust Bowl and the Depression, Double D. And then finds himself by fate on the island of Iwo Jima in February and March of 1945, and then comes home and lives his life. So you hear those interviews and guys like that, and just so thankful that you were able to be part of that. And he would consider you a peer in the organization. Yeah, and you could stand next to him. Pretty cool stuff. So, on a Tuesday, happy birthday to everybody. The appropriate greeting all week is, happy birthday, Marine. Happy birthday to Marines. Happy birthday to our kids. Happy birthday to our extended family. Right? Happy birthday to other people that are part of our tribe. Right. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. And it's just as much their birthday as it is our birthday, right? So, happy birthday. Yeah, it's one of the cool weeks in the Marine Corps. So, have yourself a great birthday. On a Tuesday, don't be afraid to change somebody's life. All Marine Radio, out.